Hey everybody, I'm an alcoholic named Kenny Hardy. Mike, thanks for asking me to come out tonight. Everything I did today was a plan to lead me up to this moment. When I first got sober, a guy told me the simplest way to start getting a hold of this program was to show up at a meeting and then plan your whole day on showing up to the next meeting, and then start meeting people, and then show up again at the next meeting and connect with other people and find out what meetings they go to. And so plan my life around showing up at meetings. So I'm not doing that very well these days. I'm not as active as I'd like to be in AA, but sobriety has led me in some different directions, which have been a positive thing for me. My sobriety date is December 21st, 2007. That was my second sobriety date in Alcoholics Anonymous. My first goes back into the 90s, and I'll tell you a little bit about that story. I was born in 1962, so I just celebrated my 62nd birthday. I was the youngest of four kids. I was born in Norfolk, DePaul Hospital. Raised in Virginia Beach for a while, moved down to Alabama when I was like 7 years old, lived there for about 5 years. My father was a salesman. He sold the old calculators that were so big you had to put them under your arm like this, you know, back in the 50s and early 60s. And we moved down there when he got a promotion. And like I said, I was, 7, 10 years old, and my brother, I was the youngest of four. My brother was 10 years older than me. My oldest sister just celebrated her birthday. She is 8 years older than me, and I have another sister who's 3 years older than me that she's lost to this disease. I don't know if she's in an institution or out in the streets or dead. I really don't know what's going on with her. My brother took his own life in 1987 over this disease. He was heavily into drinking, but also some other chemicals that he was big in the bouncer scene down in the beach in the mid 80s, and he just got to the point where he was gotten himself way in too deep and way too much trouble, and finally took his own life one night. Backing up, we grew up in I grew up in the 60s and 70s, so I don't want to tell you that I'm a baby boomer, but some people say I am. I'd like to think of myself as a Gen X, you know what I mean? But, I was born in 62. They say 64-ish was kind of that thing. But we grew up outside. We grew up not like kids do today. So it was always hunting, fishing, hanging out in ditches and riding bikes and jumping ramps and all those kind of things that you can see on the internet that we did. And, I also learned to, my siblings were older than me, so there was a lot of smoking pot and drinking Boone's Farm wine and all that stuff that was going on around me. And my first drink was when I was 10 years old. My brother had an old bread truck that he had turned into a party vehicle, had like bunk beds in it and all that stuff, and all his friends they'd park it and they'd all sit around and drink Boone's Farm wine. And I remember sitting in there. It was like the first time I had a drink of any alcohol, and I thought I was the coolest thing. I was 10 years old. And that bottle came around to me, and I grabbed it with all I had and just turned it up and drank it. And I'll never forget that moment. 10 years old, I didn't drink every day after that, but I believe that I was born an alcoholic. Alcohol said and did something for me that nothing else ever did. It made me feel excited. It made me feel a part of something. And by the time I was 13 years old, I was trying to drink every chance I could. I remember several times when me and my friends would steal bottles from one or the other's parents, and we would literally drink a bottle of whiskey on the way to school in eighth grade. That's the kind of alcoholic that I started out as. I mean, it was insane. So that kind of drinking continued for a long time. Got in some trouble along the way, and don't want to really focus on a lot of those things. I could get into a drunk log that's 9 miles long. But the point is that I was drinking as a teenager, every chance we'd get, you know, we were the kind of kids that, you know, we didn't come in until 9:30 at night, and the parents didn't care. And, you know, I'd usually come in drinking. We'd get the young sailors to go to the 7-Eleven and buy us cases of beer. We'd all split it and sit around, you know, in the woods or in some kind of neighborhood spot in the park or something, and drink as many beers as we could before we had to go home. And that was a regular thing for me for a number of years, you know, listening to Southern rock and drinking beer and smoking weed and all that stuff is the way I grew up. As my brother used to say, sex, drugs, rock and roll, and not necessarily in that order, you know. That's the kind of life that I was brought up around. So I didn't fit in very good in high school. Like I said, I drank a lot. And I drank a lot because I didn't like the way I felt. By the time I got to high school, I started developing really bad acne, cystic acne, on my face, my chest, my back, and I started really feeling horrible about myself. So I hated school, and it wasn't because of the people in school, it was because of me. And I knew that you had to feel the same way about me as I did, which was not very good. So I drank when I could, I got high when I could. I pushed people away because I didn't want them to like me for the reasons that they liked me. I wanted them to like me for my reasons, because I had to be in control of that because of the way I felt. So I hated school, and it was because of that. It wasn't because I was a bad student. I mean, I was a great student up until the point where that kind of stuff, that social anxiety, started happening to me. And I ultimately quit school in the 10th grade. And I ended up going to work with my family. We actually had a snow ski shop in right over by Lynn Haven Mall that we had opened for a few years. And I did that for a while, and then ended up working at Snowshoe as a ski instructor back in 81. That winter, I lived up there for a while, drinking and partying and having the time of my life, away from all the responsibilities and all the cares and things like that. But my drinking and all that stuff escalated. And when I came back, I was literally drinking every day. If I had money, I was drinking. And I ended up going to work with my father because I had some skills. I took electronics in high school, and I was just good with my hands and with tools and stuff. And he had a business machines company that was in business for almost 20 years, I guess. Mailing and shipping systems, calculators, all that kind of stuff. We worked on those, and I did that for about 10 years. But, you know, backing up to my high school days, I would, you know, I was drinking. When I come home from school, I would, you know, nip the bottle from my dad's, and, you know, it was, we were the kind of kids that the parents were out working, and, you know, we just did what we did. But from 1976 to 1996, a lot of things happened in my life, but it's a great big blur. I mean, I was literally more or less some kind of messed up almost every single day. I mean, I got pulled over in the middle of broad daylight over on Holland Road one time. I was driving in my orange Volvo, and I'm like, had, you know, eaten five Quaaludes and you know, crashing into bushes and stuff like that, and they're trying to figure out what was wrong with me, and they couldn't get me for drinking because I hadn't been drinking. I was just a train wreck. So that was a story up until my adulthood. I started working with my father, and he sent me up to Richmond to run a small office for him up there. This was in 1984. So I was 22 years old, and I got my first DUI. I was living up there with my young wife, my first child, my daughter, was born in 1984, and I was basically on my own doing service for these machines that we worked on, and I got my first DUI. It was late in one afternoon. I was coming off the interstate. That's when they had the little dimes they had to throw into the basket, and I ran into the rear end of somebody or something like that happened, and I got nailed for a DUI, and I was 22 years old, and I blew a .23. And this was late in the afternoon. I mean, I was hammered. And so I ended up going to ASAP for the first time. It was level 2 ASAP because the judge seemed to think that I had a drinking problem at, you know, blowing a .23. It was above my actual age when .08 was the legal limit. And that was my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a salesman that was working for us up there that he was in recovery. He was in AA and NA, and he took me to an AA meeting in the middle of downtown Richmond at noontime, and it was like 250 people in this building. I forget what actual building it was, but there was, you couldn't imagine. It was just, that's when everybody smoked in the room. It was a smoke-filled room. You had you know, executives there, you had trash collectors, you had everybody in between. It was just, I was like, oh my God, what is this thing? So it was a kind of a big turnoff for me. It was just overwhelming. And, you know, this guy tried to talk me into going to meetings repeatedly, but I wasn't ready to stop drinking. So I just, you know, I told the counselors and ASAP what they wanted to hear, kind of went through the motions, and I got myself back together. And because I was the youngest of four, and my parents had seen all this stuff going on with my brother, and all this was prior to him checking out, they were pretty great enablers. You know, they would pick up the pieces, brush us off, send us on our way, and really not make any corrections or help us make any corrections in our lives. So I was a full-blown alcoholic with no direction in life. I had a young wife and a kid, a DUI, and all I could think of was getting the next drink. You know, I was drinking during the day and between service calls and all that kind of stuff. And that went on for 3 years. And the only reason I left Richmond was, well, I can't say the only reason I left Richmond was when I got the phone call, I think it was December 7th, 1987, when my younger sister called me up in the middle of the night and told me that Alan had was dead. And so I'm away from the family, and everybody's just freaking out. And so I went home, come to find out he had stepped in the shower and put a gun to his head. And but you know what our family did? We tried to blame other people, and we just drank about it. You know, I remember my mother, I don't know if she was an alcoholic or not, but she was a binge drinker. When she drank pretty good. My dad was one of those that he could have two drinks every night after dinner and be done with it. But my mother was a little different. But we just sat there and drank and bitched about what happened, and nothing else changed. I moved back to Norfolk, Virginia Beach. At that point, had two young children, and my wife moved into a townhouse right off of Newtown Road and continued to work for my father. Got my second DUI in 1988. And that's when I got the ultimatum from my father that I was either going to lose my job, and that's pretty hard to do when your dad's going to fire you. You know, I was going to lose my job, or they put me into treatment. So I went to a Tywood Psychiatric Institute, TPI, out there on First Colonial Road when it was still there, 1988, did a 30-day stint there. Of course, I was second time around in ASAP, so I did the 30 days, then I did the ASAP, and you know, I remember that, oh, you know, Mr. Hardy, you could teach the ASAP class now and all this kind of stuff since I'd been through it before. I mean, it was just so ridiculous. But this was just the beginning of my drinking. So to make a long story short, I did 30 days, and the things that I remember was standing out the back door at the treatment facility with some other people smoking cigarettes, and everybody back there was going, yeah, we're going to be the ones that make it. You know, we're done. We're going to stay sober, and we're going to be the ones. Knowing that one in 30 might have a chance coming out of the 30-day treatment. And, you know, I stayed dry after that with the ASAP stuff, with the young wife and the two kids who resented the fact that now I was having to work, then I had to come home, then I had to go to AA meetings, then I had to go to ASAP meetings. She started resenting all of that. she wasn't an alcoholic, but she came from a codependent family. Her father was an alcoholic. And so that got pretty rough. 6 months of, as my wife would call it, sobriety. You know, I just didn't drink. Went to a few meetings. I remember going to a Halloween party and thought I was the coolest one there because I wasn't drinking. And everybody else was acting a fool, you know what I mean? And I was the kind of drunk, when I was at a party, man, you were stepping over me by the, you know, the middle of the night because I was drinking so fast. By the time 8 o'clock came around, I was done. I mean, you were like moving me out of the way, man. And so I just thought I was cool. You know, the whole time, I could taste that tall boy Budweiser, you know? And after about 6 months, I picked up again and started drinking. Again, like I said, it's all kind of blurry. You know, there was details that I couldn't even tell you, but I ended up getting my third DUI and I was living with, me and my wife had broken up. She went with a friend of ours and took the kids with her. I lost access to them. Then I had them for a while and I didn't, and then it just got really weird, and then I got the third DUI and lost my job. I was living with some friends. And tried to do the geographic change, and me and a buddy of mine took off down to Myrtle Beach. Both of us, neither one of us had any money. We had some broke down cars. It was an absolute joke. And my cousin came and picked us up after about 2 weeks down there. So it was literally pathetic. It was bad. So I stayed with my cousin. This was 1991. I stayed with my cousin and her husband, who was a good friend of mine. And he put me to work and, you know, kind of took care of me for a while. This is when the Desert Storm happened and all that stuff. And, you know, here I am, 1992, 30 years old. I have a pot to piss in, living in my cousin's house, and still drinking and partying like there was no tomorrow. I mean, just an absolute fool, full flight from reality. Just a full-blown alcoholic. So anyway, I ultimately left there and went and moved back in with my parents who lived down at Willoughby Spit. If you're familiar with Norfolk, that's the strip of land right there before the bridge tunnel. And I lived there for years prior to that. And I was staying with my parents, but I was, you know, it was summertime and I was unemployed. And that's back when if you had unemployment, you had to go wait for this little $60 check that would show up in the mailbox late, you know. And the first and last time I ever collected unemployment. But anyway, I got involved with drinking again. I was in and out of my parents' house, staying with other people, still didn't have a pot to piss in, just thought I was the coolest thing, and I was just an absolute drunk. And did that for a couple years, and by the time 1994 had come around, it was late, well, it was the winter, 94. I got involved with some people who were doing some other substances to help us drink longer. You know, I was doing weekends in jail for these DUIs that I got. I stayed with my father. My father would bring me back from the weekends in jail on Sunday night, and then I'd walk down to the Willoughby Inn and drink for the rest of the night. And my father, there's nothing they could do about it. I'd come home and eat sandwiches at 2 o'clock in the morning and just wreck their kitchen. You know, that kind of drunk. Just absolutely useless. So anyway, I did some things that I shouldn't have done to some people that were very good to me. I took some things that didn't belong to me, and it was a big deal at the time. And so, winter of 1994, Norfolk police, detectives, ATF, and some other people showed up at my mother's house and surrounded the house and came looking for me, and they arrested me. And that was my first sobriety day, that day that they took me down to the police precinct on Virginia Beach Boulevard at Ingleside, over there at that facility. And I was like, well, you got me, you know? And what I meant by that was you got me because just the whole insanity of the whole thing, it really wasn't about the crime that I committed. In that moment, I thought I had surrendered to the disease of alcoholism. Looking back on it and the things that happened since then and how my life progressed, it was one of the better things that ever happened to me. It took me out of the game long enough to see what was happening in my life. But ultimately, I really had just surrendered to authorities, you know? I got sober in lockup. I ended up doing about almost 6 months in Norfolk City Jail, and then another year and a couple months in the Baskerville Correctional Center out by South Hill. I was sentenced to 15 years with 8 suspended for grand larceny. So I was a convicted felon. Made first parole. God's been looking out for me the whole time, because that next spring is when the laws changed, and there wasn't any kind of paroles like I made parole on. And so I made parole. I was out in 18 months, and I did like 3 years of supervised parole and probation, and found a really good job. And it's in a career that I'm still doing today. But in the beginning, it was, I was working for myself. When I came out, my father was taking me to AA meetings. I had lost my driver's license indefinitely. I think I ultimately, with the trip down to Myrtle Beach, I think I had 5 official DUIs. I should have had 10. I was that guy that I always wanted to drive when I was drinking. I wanted to be the one that got everybody everywhere, you know what I mean? So I lost my license for an indefinite period of time. When I got out, got my act together, a whole bunch of people helped me. My father, my mother. I met my wife in AA. She was a young Navy girl with a couple kids, and she was on her own road to recovery. And we were a hot mess, but we belonged together. I mean, we really did, you know what I mean? And she helped me get to meetings, and a lot of people helped me. I literally had to go when I got out. I was trying to get my driver's license back. This is a drunk log story, and I went to do all the things and jump through all the flaming hoops that they all made me do to get my driver's license back. And I was like one of the pioneers of blowing into the machine in 1996, 1997. That was when they first started this devices on the cars, and they were like, you've got to go down to Dare County in North Carolina, because you got a DUI there you haven't satisfied. And so I went down there, went to court, and I literally had to spend a weekend in jail for the DUI that I got in 1990 down there. So it was like, I mean, I was starting to clean up the wreckage of my past right from the beginning. But anyway, so I did all the things. I got my driver's license back. I was working for myself for a while, and I ultimately found this career in what I do today, which is elevators and lifts and that type of thing, as an apprentice. And so me and my wife started putting the Brady Bunch together. I had 2 kids. She had 2 kids. The ones that had gone with my ex-wife, she was ready to move back to New York. She was tired of the kids, and I ended up in custody of them. And long story short, it was the Brady Bunch from 1997 and on. And so I started this career, and Dorothy was in the Navy, and she ended up getting out of the Navy in 2001, and on and on and on. The whole time we were not drinking. We were part of a home group. We were kind of doing the deal, but I'd never done any of the things that were suggested in Alcoholics Anonymous, other than go to meetings and participate in a home group. But I didn't do the steps. I didn't have a sponsor, because I was smarter than all the rest of y'all. I had it all figured out. I saw the steps and the traditions on the wall and understood it. And then finally somebody was talking one night about doing a 4th step and a 5th step, and I was like, well, maybe I should do that just to be part of the crew. And I wrote a 15-page autobiography, which was just all of the stuff that I kind of just told you about, and all the things that I felt like I had done wrong. And then I asked this kind gentleman that was an ex-Jesuit priest or something like that to hear my story. And that was my 5th step. It was me reading that autobiography to him. with very little comment on his part, because there was no analysis of anything. There was no understanding of what had taken place. It was just me just regurgitating this stuff that I'd written down and him kind of nodding his head. And then I just took it home and burned it in a coffee can and I was done with it, you know? So that went on for some time. You know, we bought a home. We had the cars and the house and the career and the kids and all of that stuff. And here it is, 2004. Started remodeling the house, had more responsibilities at work, not going to a lot of meetings. Got to the point where, you know, there was this doctor that used to come to the little door from Richmond every year to pick up a chip because he had moved away from that being his home group. So he'd come back and celebrate with the home group. And I was like, well, that's pretty cool. That's what I ought to start doing. And that's what I started doing. It's like I just stopped going to meetings, and every year I'd come. It was like for like 2 years. I'd go pick up a chip like I was somebody special. You know what I mean? I had like 8 years sobriety or something like that. So I stayed dry for like 10 years. But the spring of 2005, I was working out of town. I was mad at my job. I was mad at my wife. I was mad at my kids. I was mad at the world. And the frame of mind I had gotten into, because I had disconnected from Alcoholics Anonymous, and to say that, also disconnected from my higher power, it was like, if you think I'm an a-hole now, wait till you see me drunk, was my mindset. And I was out of town working business up in Manassas. Like, we still have the store up there. And I was in a hotel room, and I was just over it. It was 2005. And I just went to the 7-Eleven and bought a bottle of wine. You know, it's the textbook alcoholic, because I am a textbook alcoholic. And what I mean by that is my life is described in nearly every page of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in one way or another. It's there. And so I decided to drink a bottle of wine, because I'm not a wine drinker. I can handle that. I'm a young, you know, I'm 10 years sober. You know, I'm more mature. I got this thing figured out, and I picked up the bottle of wine and I drank it. Went back and got the second bottle of wine, drank it. I was done. So went to work the next day up in Manassas, did my thing for a couple more days and came home. You know, gotta hope nobody finds out what happened, right? And by the end of that week when I got home, I was stashed with bottles of vodka in the console of my truck. And I was drinking on the way to work. I'd stop and get the orange juice or whatever I had to do. And it had me. Like I said, I was born an alcoholic. That connection with alcohol and the things that it does, that allergy of the body, happens to me every time I pick up a drink. Without exception. You know, it says in the book that, you know, we think that we can enjoy and control our drinking. I never enjoyed it while I was controlling it. I never controlled it while I was enjoying it. That was never a thing for me. I never understood how that worked. So once I started drinking, it was no bets off. There's no off switch unless I run out or I'm in dire, I'm about to get in trouble in a big way. And then that didn't matter after a while. So here I am drinking for 6 months. My wife's still sober. 2005, 2006, things start getting really weird at work. You know, the market starts to change and all of that stuff. And I can't pretend anymore that I'm functioning in a real way, because I'm drinking every day at work and starting to not get away with it. And so it just got worse and worse, to the point where I would be so drunk in the afternoons, I'd come home early because I was sort of in a supervisor position, that I was so drunk, I was breaking off keys and doors trying to get in the house. I mean, that's, you know, how hammered I was at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So this went on for a while, and my wife finally figured out that I was drinking after about 6 months, and she decided that she was really pissed off at me. This is her story. I'm gonna just briefly say what she would say in a meeting, is that she was mad because I didn't invite her along, because that's how crazy we had gotten together. And ultimately, she picked up and we drank together for another 2 years. Kids involved and all that stuff. They were teenagers. And, you know, we actually said to them at one point, if you see us getting out of control, let us know. if we're drinking out of crazy, these are teenagers and we're asking them to supervise our behavior. And so it got really bad. And it was in October of 2007. I mean, literally, like Bill was talking about in his story, how the market had crashed. The market literally crashed here. I mean, the housing market, everything went to shit. And trying to explain what was going on with the business while I was just drunk half the time with my bosses and all that stuff was a real problem. And some things took place in my personal life that I couldn't explain. It was bad. And so there was an intervention, and I was at a point where I was so ashamed of myself that I was ready to just run. And I didn't want to be a part of anything. I didn't want to be a father. I didn't want to be a husband. I didn't want to be a son or a brother or even a coworker. I just wanted to go dig a hole. And so we went to a AA meeting. It was in October of 2007. And I remember both of us, Dorothy and I, picking up a white chip, slinging snot, crying, you know, telling on ourselves and being very ashamed. And obviously getting the warm welcome that we all give people to go out and come back, because we all have that potential. But I kept drinking and she didn't. So it took me another 6 weeks of absolute insanity, drinking and driving, and just it was getting really close to Christmas, and she decided that she was gonna support me no matter what, and it just got really bad. And so there was this day, I had come home and I was up in the loft in the house that we were in, and I had a drink in hand. And I remember that day like it was yesterday. And I finally just set the drink down and hit my knees. And I said, God, please help me. I can't do this anymore. And I have no idea where that came from, but I was sick and tired of me. I was sick and tired of what was happening, what I was doing to other people. And I can't explain it other than that. And, you know, then my ego kicks in and, you know, I start going to meetings. But my life started to change like right away. And Dorothy, my wife, she was going to the ASAP meetings because she had been sober about 6 weeks. And she was going with this guy, Roger Barron, over to the ASAP meetings on Tuesday nights. And I would see him at the Easy Does It at a different meeting. And I was in there one night. I was probably 30 days sober, you know. And I think that even today, I think it's important, if you do have trouble in Alcoholics Anonymous, for me, the best thing I could do is tell it myself. When I have a problem where I'm acting out in a way that I know is unacceptable to me and most likely to other people, to come and tell somebody else about it. Because that way it takes some of the power out of that behavior, and it keeps it from being a secret. And so I was telling everybody about how I'd screwed up and, you know, I got this thing, I know what I need to do now, and all this nonsense, because I didn't know anything about what I needed to do next. But I was telling everybody I had it all together. Didn't you know that you can read the big book online these days, and, you know, I can do all this by myself again? And this guy, Roger, he came out after the meeting and said, can you really mean all that bullshit that you're saying in the meetings? Because I don't see you doing any of it. None of it. And it really pissed me off. And I just kind of, you know, shined him on and just like, whatever. And I left the meeting. A couple days later, when Dorothy was going to the SARP meeting with him, I asked him if she would get his phone number. And so she did, and I was going to call him and tell him off, but I called him and asked him for help. And I said, Roger, can you help me? And there was this long, pregnant pause, and he's like, are you willing to do whatever it takes for victory over alcohol? Okay. Yeah. And that's when my life started to change, because I meant what I said. And see, I kept going over to this guy's house every Sunday morning at 9 o'clock for the next year. Every Sunday, big book in hand, notebook, highlighters, pens, dictionary. And the more I went, the more he told me about myself. And so I'd go back for more. because I knew he was telling me the truth. I didn't like it, but he was telling me the truth. And that I needed to hear it because, I mean, he literally said, Kenny, everything you think you know is probably wrong. Because all of the things that your life is built around, your beliefs, your attitudes, your opinions, all of that stuff has got you where you're at today. And so it was like, it doesn't matter what you think, it doesn't matter what you feel, what are you going to do about it? I said, I don't know. He said, that's the best answer you ever come up with, is I don't know. Because I'm a congenital know-it-all. I was born that way. 5 years old, I'm reading an encyclopedia to my sisters that are much older than me about blue whales and how fast a cheetah is and that kind of shit, right? And they used to call me names. I mean, that's just the way I was because it was like, I know it all. You know what I mean? And this guy told me I didn't know anything. And he was right. And so that opened up a whole other world to me that, you know, maybe that people think differently than me, because when I was drinking, you didn't think like me or drink like me, I didn't want nothing to do with you. What was the point? You know, and today I don't feel that way. But anyway, we did the deal. You know, he took me through the book, word by word, sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph. When it said pray, we pray. When it said write, we wrote. We did all the things that it said to do. You know, I did the rounds of the ninth step. You know, I did the third step prayer on my knees with Roger in his dining room, and he was on hospice dying of lung cancer. And I think the pain of what we were doing was worse than the pain that he was dealing with physically, because he was there with me with all the hurt. And it was an absolute amazing experience. It was the most awkward thing I'd ever done in my life. But it changed me forever. And there's things that I did for Roger while he was dying that I'll never tell a soul about. And that process changed me. So while this was happening, we were trying to go to a meeting on a Sunday night, Dorothy and I. And it was supposed to be one at the Easy Does It, and it was closed, and we were like, now what? Oh, let's go home. And she's like, no, we're going to find another meeting. We ended up over at Bayside Presbyterian on Sunday evening at 8 o'clock. It was the Caring and Sharing group. It was an Ask It Basket. And we started going over there on Sunday evenings, and there was a guy over there that was part of it. Dick had been running that meeting for 20 years. And another guy that lived right around the corner, Carlos, he's the one that got me involved with that home group. And Dick was ready to retire. And one night, after about 90 days of going to that meeting, Carlos pointed over to me and a friend of mine, Pete and Dorothy, and said, yeah, they're the ones right there. And they called us over at the end of the meeting, gave us a briefcase with the keys to the church, $600 in cash, all the literature, and said, this meeting's y'all's now, right? It was fine. And we took care of that meeting for like 6.5 years. And it was the greatest gift that was ever given to me. But, you know, sooner or later, we had to let go of it because people started calling it Kenny's meeting, or people started calling it Dorothy's meeting and those kind of things. And we're like, we're going to move on to some other things. But that was an amazing gift. You know, we took turns being GSR, intergroup rep, treasurer, chairperson, literature, all that stuff. We were a small group. We had a lot of people come and go, like most meetings do. But you know what? We stayed sober. And we started enjoying the fact that we were in recovery. And, you know, today I can say that I'm grateful to be an alcoholic, not just a grateful alcoholic. there was this woman in Norfolk. She's like, I'm grateful to be an alcoholic, at least I know what my effing problem is. And, you know, that really resonated with me because there's so many people that go through life that have no clue what the hell's wrong with their lives and why it's so much of a wreck. But anyway, long story short, that was 2007. A lot's changed in my life. Sobriety has led me down a lot of positive paths. There's been some pain and suffering and relationship issues, and tried to rebuild those things you know, with the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, practicing these principles in all of my affairs. I've had a bunch of people in AA work for me over the years. I still have one that still works for me, including not counting my wife, but we've been working together like 15 years. But we've had a lot of people come and go that were in the rooms, and we've tried to, you know, that's one of the ways I've tried to be of service to the still sick and suffering and those trying to make it in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have worked with a number of men and women. There's a handful of people that are still sober today that I've taken through the steps, not many. You know, I think that we are the exception. Those of us that stick around are the lucky ones. You know, sobriety was a gift that was offered to me, and I had to accept it as a gift. I had to let you all rescue me from myself. You know, like I said, I'm the born a know-it-all, and you know, when I was drowning of alcoholism and you wanted to save me, you swim out and grab hold of me. I'm down for the fourth count, but by the time you grab me, I'm like, hold me like this, swim that way. And that's the way I was. And now I don't pretend to know everything, because one of the best things I ever learned was to be able to say, I don't know. Why would I pretend to know something that I don't know? I spend a lot of time learning to know things, but you know, if I don't know it, I just don't know. So I accepted the gift of sobriety, and in doing that, I accepted the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous through the steps and the traditions and even the concepts that are part of, you know, the World Service and all of that stuff. It's a whole different thing. I'm not real active in AA today because sobriety has led me to some other places that are very demanding of me. I started out in the company that I'm in as an apprentice helper. But for the grace of God in this program, I'm the managing director of the whole thing now. It's just bizarre to me. It just doesn't add up. It doesn't calculate. It's like, how in the hell did I end up here? And I only say these things because they're not my accomplishments. They are the persistent pursuit of sobriety and really trying to live up to the principles of this program. I mentioned that I was a convicted felon. Well, that's no longer the case. I mean, I guess you could say that, but in the law and, you know, according to the law, I'm not. I'm a fully restored citizen because of the work that I've done based on the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. So all of the things that I gave away in my alcoholism has been restored to me, because I said yes when it was the right time to say yes. I used to come up here and say a lot of things and quote the big book, because I was taught the book. I was taught how to use it, and it saves my life all the time. Because like I said, I'm a textbook alcoholic. I find my life in that book. Any page I open up, I can relate to in one way or another. And so I was taught to do that, but I used to quote the big book and try to pretend that I was, you know, I didn't go as far as, you know, reciting the how it works without, you know, looking at the sheet. I didn't take it that far or anything like that, but today I don't find any of that necessary. Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. Roger told me, I mean, I've had some other sponsors, but Roger was the most profound. I had friends in AA and some sponsors along the way, but Roger was the one that turned my life around through his influence. And in the beginning, you know, we've all read in there where it talks about the ego deflation and how it works. And he said, Kenny, you're not a miracle. You're only the result of a miracle. And so he just kicked my ego to the ground. And today, I'm not trying to prove anything to anybody other than I'm grateful to be an alcoholic, and I'm grateful to be a part of this thing that is the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I lean very heavily on a relationship with my higher power today. And I even choose to call that higher power God today. And I know that for some of us, that was a very difficult process. I always believed in a higher power, just like Bill said. but I intellectualized it all, you know, put God in my pocket. And today I just know that God is with me all the time. It's just all me a matter of being willing and available to allow that presence to be part of my life. And I don't let the calamities of the world grab a hold of me like I used to. They still do. And I still am an agnostic in many ways, because I always am, you know, the alcoholic with the magnifying mind. Everything I see that I think is going to go sideways, it's going to go sideways really bad up in here. This is going to be the worst case scenario no matter what. And that's the way I see the world most of the time. Oh shit, here we go, right? But in reality, it's all just up in my head. You know, I wake up in the middle of the night, have conversations with somebody I'm not going to meet till Thursday, and it's Sunday night. You know, and I have to say, God, please take this conversation from me. I have no business having it today. And that's, you know, that's just my alcoholic mind, the magnifying mind that turns, as an old old-timer said, mountains into mouse turds. You know, mouse turds into mountains. And that's what my mind does. But for the grace of God and the fellowship of alcoholics, I'm sober today. I haven't had the need to pick up a drink since December 21st, 2007. One day at a time. Thanks for listening. Appreciate it. Thank you.